ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
At a rural picnic spot in the dark, a young man suddenly disappears.
You could nearly say an alien took him away because he's just vanished.
When more clues from that night surface, something doesn't sit right.
It's nonsensical where the stuff is. It's been scattered.
I'm Rob Bergen. Join me as I investigate what became of Jack in the new season of Unravel.
Is it a murder? Is it someone just gone missing?
You know where my son is.
Search for the Unravel podcast on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Darkness is my only friend. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. By the rivers of Babylon we sat and wept. What do all these famous lines have in common? They're all from the Psalms, ancient Hebrew texts that still nourish millions with their emotional and spiritual depth.
You know, the Psalms, it covers the A to Z of human experience, and on those very edge, the A and the Z, as it were, the very edge of the bell curve. I sort of think it's good that there can be language that people can use to talk about that with God and with other people.
Hello and welcome to Soul Search. I'm Meredith Lake. How have you come across the Psalms? Maybe in music, from Thomas Tallis to Bach, or in songs by U2, Boney M, even Coolio's Gangster's Paradise. On social media, you might have seen Psalms quoted in connection with the war in Gaza. Earlier in the year, the US Secretary of Defense used one in a prayer service at the Pentagon. Perhaps you've been to a funeral where a psalm of comfort was read out. You might even have recited psalms as part of Jewish or Christian worship. So, what are the psalms and why do they resonate so powerfully? What's at stake as they move across faiths, languages, and contexts? In this episode of Soul Search, you and I are going to find out. Firstly, with the help of Rabbi Kim Ettlinger from Temple David Synagogue in Perth. Kim, hello. In a nutshell, what are the Psalms?
For me, the Psalms are a collection of poetry that have expressed emotion over time. So the writing of the Psalms, which date back all over the place, really, it's some say as far back as Moses, but probably to about 1,000 before the Common Era when the first Psalms were written, supposedly by King David. But the idea of them is that they were written for people to be able to express different things that were going on in their lives.
What is the kind of range of emotions or experiences that they give voice or expression to? I mean, how would you sketch out their terrain in that sense?
There are some psalms that focus on illness as well as recovery, times of war and danger, and I think lots of people are using that at the moment. Mourning and bereavement, we use them a lot in funeral services, but also gratitude and celebration. And at times, you could even say they can be used for what we might say national crisis. Crises that happen in the world, that the Psalms can be expressed for all those kinds of emotions that we feel as humans. And it's the most, I would say, diverse collection of poetry, religious poetry, liturgical poetry that we use.
In Hebrew, I understand this very remarkable collection of poems, as you say, is summed up with the phrase or the word Tehillim.
Yes.
What does that mean and why is that the name given to this collection?
The word Tehillim comes from the Hebrew word for Hallel or to praise. And it's in connection, obviously, with God. I say obviously because we're talking on the spiritual level and I'm a rabbi. It may not be obvious for a lot of people, but yeah. And I think what we all understand as God is different for different people, but that's a different soul search program, I think.
Possibly. But it's, I guess, a poetry that has a certain use, can we say, for praise, at least in some contexts. Is that a fair way to describe the Psalms?
Absolutely, because they all at different points mention God and our relationship with God, even if it's in a difficult time and we're trying to understand what's going on in the world, and we refer to the Psalms for that. So they are very much present for that reason.
Tell me more about where these texts come from.
Sure. So, for example, they say that some of the earliest ones, for example, Psalm 23, which is commonly known as "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want," in Hebrew, Adonai ro'i lo echsar. That it's quite possible that that goes back all the way to King David, what we might call the early Davidic time, and that's around 1000 to 970 before the Common Era. So we're looking at, if we're 2026 and we're going back, so we're looking at about 3,000 years old. Mm. And you can usually tell the dating of the Psalms by the language they use, the phraseology, what they're referring to in the historical period. Also, you know, the Hebrew, is it more of an ancient Hebrew or is it a younger or a newer Hebrew? And sometimes there's a bit of Aramaic thrown in into the text as well. And that also tells us that that's a later Psalm.
So what kind of time span do you think they were written over?
I would say it's probably close to 1,000 years, because the editors that put together, as we know, the Book of Psalms with 150, the final compilation was probably done between about 400 and 200 before the Common Era. So you could say they were completed, to put it in Christian terms, about 200 years before the birth of Jesus. So that's where we're going. So they are ancient.
It's interesting that so many of the Psalms are attributed to King David, because he's a complicated figure.
Yes,
he's not
he is.
Always exemplary in his behaviour. And that. So how do you hold texts that come from a morally fraught figure, I guess? How does that play into what they offer?
I think it's perfect in many ways, because King David, like Moses, like Joshua and the prophets, they were flawed people. We're flawed people. And I think that, you know, that makes it even more real and relatable. When we look at our biblical figures, and if they were perfect, we'd go, well, we can never become like them. We can never aspire to that kind of greatness. But the fact that they are flawed represents also the flaws that are in each of us, the things that we may not get right. So I think it makes it even more sacred, even more relatable. I don't think our biblical figures are ever meant to be perfect. They're just like us today.
To come back to this idea of Tehillim or praises, I'm really curious about how this poetry, these works are used in your own synagogue, Rabbi Kim, at Temple David there in Perth. How do the Psalms feature, I guess, in the life of your community?
Psalms are prolific in everything that we do. They're in our daily services. They're in the festival services. We have different sections that focus purely on Psalms, and there's a selection of Psalms that were used because these are reflecting 2,000 years ago, 2,500 years ago in the time of the temple, the first temple that was destroyed in 580 before the Common Era, and the second temple that was destroyed in 70 of the Common Era. And the Psalms were shared at that point by the priests, by the Levites. The Psalms really take us back to that time. So we take that and we bring that into our service today, which we've done for 2,000 years. So this is not new. It goes through our services, our daily services, our Shabbat services, our festivals and high holidays. And then, of course, they can be used at times of weddings, funerals, and other life cycle events. So we use them constantly for the different ways that they were intended.
Mm. It sounds like they function as a profound anchor, in fact, of Jewish story and identity.
Absolutely. Our services just wouldn't be the same without them. So it's something that I want to say we can't live without, to be blunt.
And so how do you actually do this? I know that the Psalms have an extraordinary history in music, that's to say the very least, but how do they sound, if you like, in the life of your community, Rabbi Kim? Who sings them? What tunes do you use? What languages are they taken up in? Tell me about, I guess, the oral footprint of these Psalms. Yeah.
Sure. I'll start with your last question in terms of the language. They're done in Hebrew. We recite them in Hebrew. Very rarely do we read them in English, because it just doesn't have the same feel and it doesn't feel for us authentic. We do some in English, but mostly we've done in Hebrew. Some are set to brilliant pieces of music and even contemporary music. So Psalm 150 can be just chanted, or we do it to one of our most famous composers, Lewandowski, of blessed memory. He was prolific in writing music and set a lot of the Psalms to music, and it sounds very grand. And then that same Psalm, you know, Leonard Cohen put, he's also of blessed memory, he also put it in a contemporary musical setting that we sing, because he wrote a piece for Hallelujah. And so we take that melody and just put it into with the Hebrew words, and it works absolutely beautifully.
So how do you decide that as the leader of this community?
I think it's the mood. So if we're having a very formal service, like a high holiday service or a grand service, then we'll set Psalm 150 to Lewandowski, which is very, very high and complicated music. But if we want a more general, kind of like let's have a more, what we say in Yiddish, a Hamish, a more warm, relaxed atmosphere in services, then we'll set Do Hallelujah to either a Leonard Cohen, because people can relate to it, it's contemporary, or to one of the other more gentler pieces. And we're fortunate that there's, you know, people have over time have really been prolific in finding different, even today, settings for the Psalms.
That's Psalm 150. Let everything that has breath praise the Lord. Performed by Leslie Emery and Tali Millo to the famous tune by the late Leonard Cohen. A tune that's often used by the community at Temple David Progressive Synagogue in Perth. I'm Meredith Lake, with you for Soul Search on Radio National, exploring the emotional resonance of the Psalms, their spiritual depth, and how and why they matter so much to different communities today. Rabbi Kim, I know that you grew up as part of the community at Temple David. I wonder if you could just paint me a little bit of a picture of that community and how it was important for your family and how you were introduced to the Psalms back then.
Sure. So we joined the community in the end of 1988 when we moved from South Africa. And my parents and I have continued to be associated with the synagogue, with the shul. And while I've been out of Perth for many, many years, coming back to Temple David was very familiar, because when growing up, when we used to do the Psalms in services, it was just something that you walked in and you said, oh, I'm home. This is my space. And that sense of community, which is still there today, continues to create that space for members that I felt growing up and I felt as a child. But at the same time, we do have the tensions that emerge within progressive communities of how do we continue to be progressive? How do we progress while maintaining a sense of respect and honor for traditions that people still relate to, and then adding in contemporary music like the Leonard Cohen piece that you just shared. And let me be honest, it's not just Temple David that does these pieces. It's the different progressive shuls around Australia and around the world also use it. So when we walk into each other's synagogues and these psalms are done to the same music, even if it's the contemporary pieces, we feel at home. We feel that connection. We feel that this is, we're not just one community in Perth, but we're part of a wider network of synagogues, progressive synagogues around Australia, around our region and around the world.
Tell me more about that. How does the use of Psalms vary from, say, progressive to Orthodox synagogues?
The way that we use it is very similar, but the musical settings will be different, because we in the progressive community, we're very comfortable using piano or organ and guitar, percussion, drums. So we will often, when we sing Psalm 150, which talks about musical instruments, guess what we're going to do? We're going to use musical instruments. But in many cases within the Orthodox setting, especially if they do it on the Sabbath and the festivals, they're not able to use musical instruments because it's a Shabbat prohibition. It's something you're not meant to do on the Sabbath. So at other services, they may do it. So you can walk in and you can hear the psalms chanted, and some of them may sound familiar because we do some of the same chanting. But at other times, it'll be quite different.
Mm.
But there's still the familiarity, and I think that's the main point.
You've been talking about the Psalms as, I guess, a bridge to a certain past, a bridge across different traditions of Judaism. But I'm curious about how you hold differences of understanding and interpretation. Judaism especially has really robust traditions for holding disagreements or differences of interpretation, the whole tradition of Midrash.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if you could talk to me about that and how reading the Psalms differently is part of the tradition that you've inherited.
Sure. We look at the Psalms on different levels. We can look at it just on the plain level, or what we call the Peshat, which is just the straightforward meaning of the texts. So for example, when David flees from Saul, we use Psalm 3, or a national crisis and wars, Psalm 44 and Psalm 74. But what the Psalms try to do is they express the voice of our people. And so if we look into the deeper meaning of the Psalms, we can start to feel a different kind of connection. So when I do Psalm 23, I think this is a good example, and I do it often at a funeral because it talks about walking through the valley of the shadow of death. What I do with the valley of the shadow of death is I talk about the valley, and this is the modern interpretation on something ancient, but it's not changing the meaning of the psalm. I would say it's adding to it. And this is what we do as rabbis. So for me, when I speak to mourners and I talk to them, well, you're now walking through a valley of the shadow of death. But for each of you, your valley is different. Some of you are in a very deep valley because of your relationship with your loved one who has passed on. But for some of you, it's a different experience. So when we look at interpretations, that's where we go.
Hmm. Yeah. Even as the Psalms have these really intimate roles in people's lives, as you say, at a time of great mourning or bereavement, they also get taken up in kind of political and even kind of global ways. And I've noticed just recently the Psalms being quoted in connection with all kinds of world events, and particularly with the current war in the Middle East. I'm sure you'll have noticed this too. The US Secretary of Defense, Pete Hegseth, referred to some of the cursing psalms when he led prayers at the Pentagon earlier in the year.
I wasn't familiar with that, but I've heard about it recently.
Well, yeah, I mean, there've been examples. I mean, he's just one of, you know, public figures using the psalms even to pray violence or vengeance on people, which is a very different thing to the kind of comfort that you're talking about. And I wonder what you make of that, how that kind of thing comes up, if it does, in your community. How do you feel when you see the Psalms being used in that very, very different context to the one you've been talking about at your own synagogue?
Well, I think there's contradictions. And I think I haven't heard exactly what Pete Hegseth said. I haven't seen the Psalms that he used in that context. We can use them for blessings. We can use them for curses. I don't like using the word curses, but I think it's got to fit the setting in which it is. But I'm sure many people in Israel and around the world and in, you know, have used the Psalms exactly like that, because it's nobody has a particular ownership of understanding. His version and his brand of Christianity would use it in a particular way, and we're going to wreak vengeance, and and that's the world in which Pete lives. I'm calling him Pete, but you know, Secretary of Defense or Secretary of War, whatever his title is, that's the world in which he lives. So he's going to use the Psalms in that particular way. You know, I'm not going to use the Psalms in that way. I'm going to try to use them for comfort and for peace, but you know, they can be used in any which way. And as I said, no one religion or one branch within a religion, you know, has the ownership over how Psalms should be interpreted.
Well, Rabbi Kim, to come back to your context and the way you hold these texts and the way you choose to use them, I wonder how you found the Psalms in recent times. I'm just so conscious that in the last couple of years, and especially this year, Jewish communities have been facing extraordinary challenges.
It's cool. What it is, it's anti-Semitism at its highest. It's not just challenges, it's anti-Semitism.
And terrorist attacks, frankly, here in Australia, mm-hmm. in a way that I think we are still and rightly shocked by. What do the Psalms offer in these kind of times, in the face of extraordinary pressures, discrimination? Where is there comfort in the Psalms, perhaps for you and for your community?
That's a beautiful question. I think that the Psalms offer both hope that things will be different, that we can walk towards a sense of peace and understanding, but I think the Psalms also offer comfort for grief and for mourning. Even within the Psalms, I think we recognize that what our community here is facing, and it's not just here, it's across the world, but we're feeling it here acutely, and now we have a royal commission. The Psalms offer a sense of hope, of peace, of comfort and healing, which is incredibly necessary. And in some very Orthodox, Jewish Orthodox circles, when somebody has been injured or hurt, members of the community, all they will do is read Psalms for 24 hours or for however long. People will gather at a bedside or in homes. And what they do, it becomes like a mantra of comfort. When you constantly sit there and you're repeating the Psalms and you're reading them, it feels like you're doing something, even if you're helpless or you can't do anything. It gives people a sense of peace, inner peace, which is so important, connecting to their soul, their nefesh. Nefesh is soul in Hebrew. And hopefully asking God to bring healing and comfort to their loved one. And there would have been a lot of people in Bondi and in the Jewish community in Bondi, and certainly we did it here and around the world, to recite Psalms, Psalms of healing, Psalms of hope and connection. And we did it when we did a service of healing, because people needed to come together and gather after Bondi. People didn't know how to express what they were feeling. And so we offered them, let's read some Psalms together. I certainly did that personally in my office with people, but communally as well. And constantly praying for peace and safety and using the Psalms to do that.
Rabbi Kim, would you share some of those Psalms with me? Which Psalms did you choose? Which one spoke to you most powerfully in that time, in this time?
I think Psalm 16. I can read a little bit of it for you in Hebrew and in English. Mm.
Please.
Shaviti Adonai lenegdi tamid ki mimeni bal emot, lachen smach libi v'agel kavodi, af besari yishkon lavetach. I've only read a part of it, but the English is, I have set the eternal always before me, God is at my side, I shall not be moved. Therefore does my heart exult and my soul rejoice, my being is secure. For you will not abandon me to death, nor let your faithful one see destruction. You show me the path of life. Your presence brings fullness of joy. Enduring happiness is your gift. And that's really a psalm of comfort. And it's one, certainly I've done it at funerals, but I'll do in mourning services and comfort services, because it says, you'll not abandon me. Your foot will not move. You're always next to me. You are ensuring that my inner soul is intact with all the trauma that we might be dealing with and going through. And you're going to show me life. You know, that's what we're saying in the psalm. We're saying to God, you're going to show me life. And we know that your presence is here. And eventually, together, because we're in a relationship, we're in a covenant with God, together, that's going to bring joy and happiness. That is your gift to us. So while we're going through this dark period, we know that eventually you're going to bring us life. I think it's attributed to King Solomon, who said, Gam ze yavor. And I actually have a ring that I wear. Gam ze yavor means this too shall pass. Recognizing that no matter how bad and difficult things are in our lives, whether we're facing deep anti-Semitism or criticism or war or the tragedies of Bondi, it's going to pass because that's the nature of life. But it also tells us, you know, when things are good, when there's peace, that it can be fleeting. It can really be fleeting. And so, Gam ze yavor, this too shall pass. The good will pass and the bad will pass. And it's that reality check. And, you know, that's, I think, also reflected in this psalm of Psalm 16.
On a personal level, do you have a favourite psalm, one that's really resonating with you at the moment, perhaps apart from Psalm 16? Is there another one that's been close to your heart in recent times?
Yes, I think there's Psalm 121. I just want to say, I think it's one of the most beautiful psalms. Mm.
And what's it about? What is it that connects to you?
It's about looking forward, looking forward to the mountains, looking forward for hope, but also feeling that we're not alone. It goes like this: Shir lamalot esayinai el heharim me'ayin yavo ezri. I turn my eyes to the mountains. From where does my help come? Ezri me'im Adonai oseh shamayim va'aretz. My help comes from God, maker of heaven and earth. And then for me, the next line is the key. Al yiten lamot raglecha al yanum shumrecha. Hine lo yanum v'lo yishan shomer Yisrael. God will not let your foot give way. Your guardian will not slumber. See the guardian of Israel. Neither slumbers nor sleeps. Adonai shumrecha, Adonai tzilcha ad yaminecha. Yomam hashemesh lo yakeka v'yareach balayla. See the guardian of Israel. Neither slumbers nor sleeps. God is your guardian. God is your protection at your right hand. And I think for me, that's feeling, when I share that, when I read that, I feel so connected to God, because I recognize that, you know, God isn't sleeping. God understands exactly what's going on in the world. I don't think God has created the conflict. People have created conflict. But we're not alone, and we can feel a sense of God's love and God's protection, especially around us. Because God is very much present. But I want to say, I don't think religion creates wars. I certainly believe that it's people and their interpretation and misinterpretation of texts, whether it's Psalms or other books of the Bible.
Thank you. Rabbi Kim, thank you so much for opening up these texts and what they mean over time in your community and perhaps even in the world. I'm so grateful to you. Thank you so much for joining me on Soul Search.
Oh, you're so welcome. It's been wonderful. Thank you so much. And thank you for such beautiful questions and important questions.
Kim Ettlinger is the rabbi at Temple David, a progressive synagogue in Perth. She was sharing some of the psalms that have meant a lot to her and her community. I'm Meredith Lake, and no, it's not the Vicar of Dibley. It's Soul Search on Radio National, Radio Australia, and by podcast. But this setting of Psalm 23 is the theme song for that quintessentially English TV series. Composed by Howard Goodall, you're hearing a recording by Sinfonia Australis, featuring soprano Jane Sheldon and David Stanhope conducting. It's a prime example of how an originally Hebrew text that's been used in Jewish worship for a couple of thousand years has travelled across time, across contexts and cultures. One person who's thought a lot about the Psalms and their mobility is Adelaide's Matthew Anstey. He's an internationally renowned Hebrew scholar and an Anglican priest. In the last few years, he's taken on the mammoth task of retranslating the Psalms from Hebrew into English. Matthew, I'd like to start with that particular psalm, The Lord is My Shepherd, Psalm 23. What is it about? What does it evoke for you?
It's interesting you chose that one. I mean, obviously, it's the most famous psalm. It's actually quite unusual as a psalm for several reasons. Yeah. The most striking thing about it is it seems to mix its metaphors pretty dramatically. So the first four verses are about God as a shepherd, guiding us, particularly through challenging times, even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, that famous third verse. But then verse 5 switches entirely. It says, "You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil and my cup overflows." And it sort of shifts gears entirely to this different type of image. And scholars have spilled a lot of ink trying to understand this, whether it's originally two psalms have been brought together. There's other theories. And it's unusual in terms of its movement from beginning to end.
I mean, it's interesting that it is not quite what you expect, even when it is more familiar than perhaps most of the psalms are these days. Why do you think it is so famous?
That's a good question. I do think it's the combination of the imagery of the shepherd and the shepherd leading the sheep beside these still waters, these green pastures, and the rhythm that comes through from comes in the Coverdale translation into the Book of Common Prayer, and the King James Version captures that in that very famous fourth verse. "Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I fear no evil, for you are with me, your rod and your staff, they comfort me." And there's just something about that that speaks deeply to the human condition. In my work as an Anglican priest, I'm sometimes with people, obviously, in the last days and weeks of their life. And it's the psalm that's most commonly requested by families or by the person at the end. And it's very commonly selected at funerals. So it's something about God being with us through the thick and thin. And also it sounds musical and it rolls off the tongue, put it that way.
And it has been set to music in some very famous ways as well.
Yeah, of course. And it was quite a challenge to translate, because the more famous a text of Scripture is when one translates it, the more people are expecting the traditional language, and they want something familiar, particularly in a liturgical translation that I'm doing, which is for use in public worship. So my translation is only varies in a few places from the Anglican psalms that we've been using for 50 years in our churches. And
where did you make your changes? Because it is, in a way, to vary, as you say, something deeply familiar has always got to be a bit scary. So what changes did you make, Matthew?
So the Book of Common Prayer, which is based on the Coverdale translation, in the first verse, it says, "The Lord is my shepherd, therefore can I lack nothing." And that second half, I know.
That's not really poetry.
Exactly. It
therefore can I lack nothing.
Yeah, it doesn't flow. And so I actually just went straight back to the King James for that. "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want." So I'm not actually even been original there, but I feel that it's rolls off the tongue a lot better. But it's an interesting sort of theological one, which probably does reflect sort of some of our new thinking about how we perceive the divine. In verse 2 in the Anglican Prayer Book of Australia version, it says, "He," meaning God, "He will make me lie down." And as I reflected on that, God's very active and we're passive, as it were, like we're made to lie down. "He will make me lie down." And I thought I wanted something a little bit less...
more collaborative.
It didn't sound like we've been acted upon. And it's a simple little change I put in: "Green pastures, he gives me rest. Beside still waters, he leads me," which is a totally valid way of translating the Hebrew. And... yeah, I think that image of he makes me lie down is a little bit overbearing.
Or it may sound overbearing to a contemporary ear, perhaps in a way that it didn't back then. Who knows?
Yes, yeah. So that's one of the things we're sensitive to and have more. We think about God in different ways in 2026 than this translation was done in the early 1970s.
And the translations that you are harking back to in many ways are much older than that.
Yeah.
But that example of Psalm 23 is interesting, isn't it? Because you've got really famous and potent imagery, lines that have resonated with people, particularly in hard times. There's an emotional heft to that psalm that I think helps explains its popularity.
Yes.
And in a way, I wonder if that's partly what makes the psalms collectively so resonant. Can you elaborate on what the psalms are more broadly? And is Psalm 23 in some ways a portal to a collection that has those qualities?
Yeah, I think so. I think it is. The psalms, the majority are written in first-person perspective. Psalm 42, that very famous psalm, as the deer longs for streams of water, so my soul longs for you, O God. My soul thirsts for God, for the living God. When shall I appear before your face? And so it's very personal and intimate. But then the psalmist shifts in that psalm, the third verse, my tears feed me by day and by night, ever saying to me, where is your God? I'm reading from my own translation. And then verse 5, very famously, why are you downcast, O my soul, troubled within me? Hope in God, for I shall yet praise his saving presence.
So you get, doubt and anguish and just a
questions.
Sense of abandonment.
Correct, yeah.
As well as a sense of the nearness of God that you spoke about earlier.
Yeah, so the Psalms are very extremely realistic. They don't band-aid over the problems. They sort of talk about the harsh realities, and also that a living faith in God is one that is full of questions about God and about God's presence. The psalmist often says, where are you? Why have you not responded to me? You sometimes even say, why are you sleeping, God? Wake up and do something. So they can be demanding. They can be, and they do really cover the whole kaleidoscope of our interior life. But they also very much focus on the whole of creation and the wider world. So,
I mean, that interiority that comes through so strongly with the first-person voice, as you've said, is often accompanied by the fact that these are collective texts in that they were used from the outset and certainly are still used today by people together, so that even when they sing or say, I, they do that with others.
Yeah, I mean, that's Christian and Jewish worship, and I'm sure in other religious traditions as well, it very much is about being together, and worship is sort of intrinsically egalitarian in the sense that we gather together, sing the same songs, and in the Christian tradition, you gather around the table for the bread and the wine. So the bread and the wine in a communion service, the previous person could have been the king and the next person could have been an unemployed person and a four-year-old and then a 95-year-old and everything in between. Although we each say I, and we often also use we language as well, but the liturgy itself and our faith itself binds us together, but without homogenizing, right? Like we retain our differences, and with all things of life, the sum's always greater than the parts. But you're exactly right. The I doesn't matter because it's a single voice, but what matters is that chorus of voices. Like in a choir, everybody's singing individually, but what you hear is the combined sound.
I have to say, Matthew, that some of the psalms I find very confronting, even possibly extremist in ways that unsettle me. There is shocking violence, serious curses. There is despair that is, in Psalm 88, utterly unrelieved.
Yes.
That psalm ends with the very famous line, darkness is my closest friend.
Mm-hmm.
What do you make of those, the less than tame psalms?
Yes. A few things I'd want to say. I think this is an issue right across the whole of the Bible. It's not just in the Psalms. As we would say, the Old and the New Testament. There's passages in the Gospels in the story of Jesus that are, I find, just equally as shocking and confronting. So firstly, that's what I want to say, is that we have a problem. There's problematic texts across the whole of the Scriptures. And part of the issue here is that the Scriptures they always need interpretation. You can read them yourself and you obviously make an interpretation, but they're always they always need to be contemplated and wrestled with and thought through. So it's a bigger problem. We can't get rid of it just by taking out the bits we don't like. The second thing is, I do think context is incredibly important. And you know, sometimes I've read these psalms. You know, some psalms are really asking for their enemies to be, you know, done away with in one way or another.
And in very shocking ways. I mean, famously, sure. Psalm 137
yes.
talks about the smashing of infants against rocks. You know, just images of such violence that even now, when we know what's in there and
yep.
it's been there for thousands of years, it's still, like, I would hate to have to read that out in a public setting or,
yeah, so,
you know.
Yeah, so I'll say a couple of things about that. Firstly, in our we don't read all the psalms out in our public worship, so we use a selection, which is what we call the lectionary. And this is all church denominations, not just Anglicans. The lectionary is used around the world, and so I think all of the cursing psalms are omitted. And psalms like 137, that section, those last couple of verses, those verses are optional, and most churches won't read them out when we come to that psalm.
And that's, I guess, a choice of interpretation that the churches have made historically as an act of collective interpretation.
Yeah, because the beginning of the
psalm
is so famous. You know, by the waters of Babylon, we lay down and wept. You know, been songs about that and everything.
Yeah,
but I was translating not that psalm, but another psalm that thought that, and there had been a really shocking stories on the news in the previous few days, both one from Gaza and one from Ukraine. And I thought, if I was a Christian at church in one of those places and I read that psalm, maybe I would think about it very differently. Like, I can't speak on their behalf, but maybe in some contexts that's how people feel. They feel they've experienced such horrors and trauma that their heart is full of a great anger towards whoever the enemy is. Yeah, so I'm cautious to say we shouldn't have this language, because the Psalms, it covers the A to Z of human experience, and on those very edge, the A and the Z, as it were, the very edge of the bell curve where people experience horrific things. I sort of think it's good that there can be language that people can use to talk about that with God and with other people.
Mm. And the moral requirements of reading well remain on the present day reader. That's the other thing, is that reading and interpreting is always a moral act, not just a technical or scholarly one.
Absolutely.
And that's true for communities as well as individuals. And I don't know, I think the Psalms and other texts that have been held sacred often make very clear how much might be at stake in our moral choices around interpretation.
Absolutely. Yeah. You can unpack that. The challenges of the scripture and their interpretation can be used and to also reflect on the challenges of our lives and our communities. Because, you know, the church is one thing that's come very clear to light in the last decades is how the church has failed so terribly in so many areas of life. And that's something we really have to grapple with. We're no longer seen, and I think correctly, we're no longer seen as having a privileged place and often we're no longer respected or trusted, certainly not in the way the church was in the middle of the 20th century. And that, for me, that's a good thing, because it means the truth has come to light about the things that have happened, but also we have to rethink our whole relationship and our place in God's world.
On ABC Radio National, Radio Australia, and by podcast, you're listening to Soul Search with me, Meredith Lake. I'm here with Matthew Anstey. He's a Hebrew language scholar and an Anglican priest, and we're talking about the Psalms, ancient poems or prayers originally composed in Hebrew at least 2,000 years ago. They were translated into Greek around the 3rd century BCE. They have a long history in Latin as part of Jerome's 4th century translation of the Bible, known as the Vulgate. And then, when it comes to English, the Psalms began their career around the time of the Reformation, with Miles Coverdale's breakthrough version influencing everything from the English Bible to the shape of English poetry. Here in Australia, Anglican churches often use a translation made in the 70s.
Matthew thinks it needs a refresh, so he set out to translate the Psalms again.
The germination, or the seeds of it began when my children were in their early teens and I was at church each Sunday. And there was a couple of verses that came across in the Psalms that really struck me. One was in our current prayer book from the 1970s, is Psalm 65, verse 11. The tracks where you have passed, in referring to God, the tracks where you have passed drip with fatness.
What?
Yeah, drip with fatness. And kids say, you know, what are we talking about fatness for? So I didn't know, looked it up. And in the 70s, that word could mean generosity and abundance. And now I only knew it as meaning obesity, right? And then the funnier one I thought was Psalm 33:10, the Lord brings to nothing the devices of the people. And yeah, my teenage kids said, what's it talking about iPhones for, you know?
God unplugs their iPhones.
Yeah, God
runs brings down their batteries.
That's right, yeah. It brings to nothing the iPads or the iPhones of the people and the devices.
That would be judgment.
Yeah, so just that word device. So I started to pay a lot of attention to the English grammar and the English meaning of words, and it made me realise more and more how much English had changed and how inaccessible the English translation that we're using every week in church was. The second thing was, you know, my PhD is in biblical Hebrew linguistics. That's where I've done my publishing and my research. We've learned an enormous amount about biblical Hebrew, the language, how it works. Most of that wasn't known in the 1970s.
Really? I mean,
they still had a very, very good knowledge, but just important things, sort of subtle things around particularly verbs and how they function and politeness forms. So, for instance, we're much more certain now that Hebrew had ways of saying sort of please by modifying the verb or adding a little particle. And like you won't find the word please in my translation either, and certainly not in the one we use every Sunday. But there wasn't even an awareness of these the difference between formal and informal language. It's only subtle and it's only in a few places, but it's just little things like that. I suppose
Why have there been those kind of subtle, as you say, but real breakthroughs in the understanding of ancient? Is it manuscript finds or just more linguistic analysis? Or just in a nutshell, how come there's been a leap there in literally in our lifetimes?
It's really the emergence of linguistics, which as a discipline is still only, well, it's, a, you know, I don't know, 100 years old or so, but really in terms of being able to do serious PhD work in linguistics, maybe 50, 60, 70 years, and there's been an explosion of interest in linguistics, particularly in what we call linguistic typology, which is comparing languages across different languages, and that's really led to a lot of insights into many languages and particularly into biblical Hebrew. There's a couple of other really big things too which are pretty significant. So one is that in the 1970s, when translators or Bible scholars had struggles with the Hebrew text, the default position was, well, let's see what the Greek translations did, what we call the Septuagint, the Greek translation of ancient Hebrew into ancient Greek. And that makes sense, we'll follow that. Sometimes they followed even the Latin. The vast majority of them have now been solved in that we now feel that there is a way to understand the Hebrew that we received. Some of the more obscure words, the meanings have been clarified. Or certainly we have a much stronger case these days for following the Hebrew. Another factor here is the Dead Sea Scrolls were known. They were discovered by the 70s, and they do occasionally refer to textual variations in the Dead Sea Scrolls, but there's a lot of the work still hadn't been done.
I mean, it's an incredible thing to sit so closely with not just a text, but with a text in multiple forms, as you do, to translate. What has this done to your own relationship to them? To sit with the Psalms as their translator in this time, in this manner, can you distill what that means for you and the vocabulary perhaps that it gives your life, your faith even?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I've always been a person interested in the inner life and in reflecting upon the meaning of life. I've always been a questioner. So it's not been such a massive revelation for me, more of a gentle confirmation that I've been sort of heading in the right direction, as it were. I think I had my big aha moment about the Psalms, you know, decades ago, and I probably needed that in a way to have enough passion and love for it in order to do the new translation. I mean, where the biggest changes for me is realizing how much, in how many ways we can do better translations, so that because one thing I was going to also talk about was the musicality, the rhythm, the sound, the vowels, just the way it sounds, which I put a lot of effort into that. And I work with, I have a sort of a committee of people I send a first draft to, which includes some poets and some composers. And they often respond at the level of the sound and the orality or the rhythm and the prosody. And so I'm working really hard to make it a psalm that's rolls off the tongue, but it's also pleasant to hear and it's good for singing. Yeah. So I think that dimension of it is something that has really grown. I've grown a much deeper appreciation of the potentials of that. But interestingly, of course, that's in English, not in Hebrew, so because the Hebrew hasn't changed.
And why do you think that is? Why is it important to you that they sing well? I mean, there's so many musical settings of the Psalms.
That's right.
Many, many people from all kinds of backgrounds have found them deeply attractive for setting to music, often in a faith context, but not only that. And as protest songs, as all kinds of things. So why is that musicality something you value so dearly?
For me, the primary reason is the place and the role the Psalms have in public worship. A lot of people don't appreciate this because if you just look at the order of service, it looks like we have four readings from the Bible. It looks like you have like an Old Testament reading, a psalm, then a New Testament reading, and then the gospel. The gospel is set apart because we stand and we have a gospel procession and we usually have a gradual hymn before the gospel. So we know the gospel sort of it stands out a little bit by itself, and primarily because this is, you know, the words of Christ and it has a central place in Christian faith. But if you look at the actual lectionary, it'll always call the Old Testament reading the first reading, then psalm, and then the New Testament reading, it's always called the second reading. It's not the third reading.
Huh.
And the reason is because the psalm is always chosen as a response to the first reading. So if that first reading is about Israel crossing through the Red Sea and through the dangerous waters, the psalm will be a psalm that talks about those dangerous waters and being saved through the waters, something like that. The other thing is, of those four parts of Scripture, it's the only one that's participatory. This is terribly important. So either the congregation sings the psalm along with the choir, and a lot of churches don't have choirs anymore. So the
no.
psalm, in many cases, the psalm is said by everybody all together, or it's said by half verse. So the reader will say the first half of the verse and the congregation will respond. But all of those things tell us what the psalms are doing in the worship is different from the other texts. It's participatory and it's responsive. Partly it's reflecting our participation in this story and our seeing ourselves in this story. Sometimes I say to people that, you know, the opposite of remember in biblical thinking is not it's not forget, but dismember, D-I-S hyphen member. And remember is like R-E hyphen member. Like, so when we remember...
To pull together or to push apart.
Yes, yeah. That. Mm. So when we remember Christ in the Eucharist, we're not just remembering, like bringing it to mind to think about it. We are remembering ourselves. We're becoming members of it. And for me, the psalm then is part of that very important corporate act of we are remembering ourselves into the story itself and becoming part of it.
What a way to understand the psalms and how they work on a community, to knit people together and into a big story that, in turn, connects them with God. That's the Reverend Dr. Matthew Anstey, an Anglican priest based in Adelaide and a Hebrew scholar currently working on a new translation of the Psalms for Anglican churches to use in their services. If you'd like to find out more about his translation project or to have a browse of some of the Psalms he's completed so far, you can head to the Soul Search website and follow the link to the Anstey Psalter. Earlier, you heard from Kim Ettlinger, the rabbi at the Progressive Synagogue in Perth. She spoke about the Psalms in their Jewish contexts. And if you missed that conversation, catch up with the Soul Search podcast. For now, thanks to producers Rowan Salmond and Hong Jiang. I'm Meredith Lake. I'll catch you next time for Soul Search on Radio National, Radio Australia, and with ABC Listen.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.